Welcome to winter, constant listeners. I know you think it's bad out there, but consider it could be a lot worse. Our air date is January 22nd, but tomorrow, January 23rd, that marks the day in 1971 when Prospect Creek Camp, Alaska, experienced the lowest temperature ever in the United States, minus 80 degrees. Ouch. Indeed, we are in the dead cold of January, but ironically, we're also in the intense heat of another march toward the Super Bowl in the NFL. And I thought a great sports dedication subject for this time around would be a reminder as to how the Super Bowl came to be and a vital precursor to what became the modern game and its penultimate event in a few weeks. Now, that vital precursor was the American Football League, or the AFL, and its story is a fascinating one. The AFL operated for 10 seasons in the 1960s, from 1960 until 1970. And in 1970, it completed a merger with the older established rival National Football League, or NFL. And when it merged into the NFL, it formed the core of the American Football Conference, or the AFC. But before merging into the NFL, that AFL was directly competing with the NFL. And from its start in 1960, all the way through to the merger, that was the case. The AFL was not the first attempt to take on the NFL. It was the fourth major attempt and the first to succeed. Three earlier rivals to the NFL carried the same name of AFL, and you saw that in the 20s, one in the 30s, and one in the 40s. It only lasted a year or so before collapsing. And there was the All-America Football Conference in the second half of the 1940s, which also failed. But this fourth version or attempt of the AFL, it succeeded in the end, and it helped form the modern NFL as we know it. The AFL was created by a group of owners who had, I'd call it, some chips on their shoulders because they had been refused NFL expansion franchises or they had only minor shares of NFL teams. They wanted a chance to take on the league that may have slighted them by starting a rival league of their own. The owners had a sense of humor. They referred to themselves as the Foolish Club. That was a term that Lamar Hunt helped promote, the owner ultimately of the Kansas City Chiefs. But these were not foolish people. Far from it. They were serious, and they were focused on success. The AFL's original lineup consisted of an Eastern division. It included the Titans of New York, the Boston Patriots, who became the New England Patriots, the Buffalo Bills, the Houston Oilers. Also had a Western division of the Los Angeles Chargers, the Denver Broncos, the Oakland Raiders, and the Dallas Texans. And some of those names you recognize today, and some they morphed into teams that you know today, which I'll get to in a second. And by the way, did you know the original name that was chosen for the Oakland team? It wasn't the Raiders. Do you know what it was? It was the Seniors. Think about that, the Oakland Seniors. Well, the AFL shocked many pundits by signing 75% of the NFL's first-round draft choices in 1960. They basically poached the entire first round from the NFL. And that included Houston signing Heisman Trophy winner Billy Cannon. Gale Sayers almost signed with the AFL, but of course he ended up with the NFL's Bears. The early years of the AFL, they were tough, no doubt about it. Attendance was low, it struggled, but the league had a big sort of advantage, an ace up its sleeve, because it had a strong TV contract with ABC and then eventually one with NBC as well. And TV money played a key role even back in the 1960s. It kept the AFL alive, frankly. And the AFL was an exciting product. That was another advantage it had compared to the stodgy NFL. The AFL style play was much more offense-minded and offensively oriented. Fans liked that, and that helped to attract even more top talent from colleges and from the NFL. And I mentioned that some of those AFL franchises, they morphed. The Chargers moved from LA to San Diego. The Texans, they moved up to Kansas City and became the Chiefs. And those New York Titans became the New York Jets under new ownership. And they signed a University of Alabama star quarterback from Western Pennsylvania, Beaver Falls, named Joe Namath, who, by the way, was Farm Metal dedication subject for episode 106. The Jets and Namath, they helped promote the AFL in Gotham and with major media, because a lot of major media was centered in New York City. The AFL head-on competition with the NFL worked its magic, placing Al Davis, who was the GM and coach of the Raiders at the time, in as league commissioner. That was another crucial move. and the leagues agreed to a merger in 1966. Among the conditions were two things that we've come to know quite well, a common draft and a championship game played between the two league champs, first played in early 67, which would eventually become known as the Super Bowl. In the merger, the AFL and NFL, they operated as separate leagues once they signed the initial merger until 1970. So they announced a merger agreement in 66, but still operated as separate leagues, meeting in a championship game until 70. And they had separate regular seasons, separate playoff schedules, except for the Super Bowl. NFL legendary commissioner Pete Rozelle, who was our dedication subject for Far Middle 146, he also became chief executive of the AFL until the merger was wrapped. The AFL expanded in the late 60s after the merger agreement. They added Miami with Dolphins. Cincinnati brought the Bengals. And after losses by the first two AFL-NFL World Championship games to the Green Bay Packers, the AFL ended up redeeming itself by having the New York Jets and those Kansas City Chiefs win Super Bowls III and IV. So now the AFL found itself on equal footing with the NFL when it came to on-the-field competition. And right on time, in 1970, the AFL was absorbed into the NFL. The 10 AFL franchises, they joined with three existing NFL teams. So they joined up with the Baltimore Colts, the Cleveland Browns, and my Pittsburgh Steelers. And that group formed the Merged Leagues American Football Conference, the AFC. And that, constant listeners, is how the modern NFL, from draft to AFC-NFC, to many of those teams you love, to the Super Bowl, it's how it all came to be. Thus, as we march toward another Super Bowl Sunday, we dedicate episode 192 of the Far Middle to the American Football League, or the AFL. Indeed, the AFL helped make the NFL of today, created a multi-billion dollar industry that's run by billionaire owners, the super wealthy elite, which connects us to the topic of paying your fair share. With so much talk these days centered around making sure that individuals and businesses, particularly those making the most, pay their fair share of tax, I thought it would be interesting to move away from the rhetoric and focus on the objective math. What do the data tell us? Because the facts tell a very interesting story. The top 1% of income tax filers, they provided over 40% of the revenue to the federal government in 2022. And that's from and using IRS data. The top 10% of filers shouldered over 70% of the total tax burden. In other words, the data show that the United States income tax system, it's incredibly and highly progressive. And this reality is important when Congress and the president get around to deciding whether to extend the 2017 lower tax rates that are set to expire at the end of 2025. The top marginal rate for higher earners is 37%, and Democrats and the left, they wanted to go back and still want to go back to the old level, just under 40%, perhaps even beyond that. And the argument, those in favor of raising the top rate from 37% to something just under 40% or beyond, is that not doing so would enrich the already super wealthy who don't pay their fair share. But that's not what the data and the facts that I just stated indicate is happening, and there's some additional sort of statistics that puts this in perspective. Yeah, the reality is that one filer out of every 100 is providing more than 40% of income tax revenue, and that top 1% is about 1.5 million tax returns. That group comprises over 22% of the nation's total reported earnings, but their share of income taxes paid was nearly double that at over 40%. And their average federal tax rate was just over 26%. So for those who say they don't pay their fair share, considering that 1% at the top pays two times more in taxes than their share of income helps put that in perspective with some data. Now, when you drop down to the next highest bracket, so this would be between the top 1% and the top 5%, you'll see that that comprises of just over 6 million tax returns, and its band of adjusted gross income is between $262,000 and $663,000. Now, that group had roughly 16% of total earnings, but it contributed almost 21% of income tax revenue, and their average tax rate was just under 19%. The third highest tier between the top 5% and 10% of earners, That's the group whose share of earnings roughly matches their share of taxes paid. So that's where you start to see some parity between share of national earnings and share of taxes paid. And then when you drop down to the lower brackets, you start to see the share of income for the that band exceed the share of tax, as you might expect. So when you add it all up, the top quarter of earners reported 70% of all income in 2022, and it paid over 87% of all income taxes. And the current tax code, including the 2017 lower tax rates, by the way, this is with those lower rates, it hits the upper income brackets harder on a progressive scale. And as the country begins to assess, again, where it goes on tax rates and which bracket ends up being impacted the most, let's make sure that those setting policy are using the appropriate data and the actual math so that everyone goes into the process with good situational awareness. Speaking of fair share and paying fair share, maybe instead of looking to burden doers and value creators in the private sector more harshly, maybe instead the federal government should first look at what's going on with nonprofits. Got some additional math and statistics for you that I think you'll find interesting. In 2019, tax-exempt nonprofit organizations, they generated over $3 trillion in income. They sat on $8 trillion in assets. They received over $180 billion in income from a range of different sources. And although nonprofits and charities, as we traditionally think of them, are included in that group, most of the biggest tax-exempt organizations operate like predatory businesses. Think of hospitals, big universities, consulting firms, credit unions, and athletic associations. The largest tax-exempt nonprofit in the nation is Kaiser Permanente, which is a hospital and insurance entity. That nonprofit generated over $100 billion in revenues and over $5.6 billion in net income in 2019 across all the different segments that it controls. Hospitals and health insurers nationwide in 2019, they enjoyed more than $60 billion in profit tax-free. And right behind hospitals and health insurance entities are the second largest tax-exempt sector, which is higher education. Almost $300 billion in revenue and over $20 billion in net income in 2019 as a sector. There were over 50 private universities reporting more than $1 billion in revenue that year, and less than 20% of university income comes from charitable donations, which exposes what I think is another popular myth. Investment income accrues tax-free for universities, or mostly tax-free, for the hundreds of university endowments, foundations, fundraising entities, and real estate holding companies. The NCAA is another great example. It enjoys over $1 billion per year in tax-free income from broadcasting rights and from sponsorships. Meanwhile, the college athlete paying income tax on their earnings. Now, having tax-exempt organizations pay the 21% corporate tax rate, that would generate about $40 billion every year. And it would help differentiate between true charities and what our commercial enterprise is parading in charity clothing. Now, revenue to run government can be viewed certainly as a scarce resource, which is why we need to consider these massive nonprofits and think about whether they should start paying a fair share of tax. But it's not just dollars that can be scarce or precious these days. A host of commodities and services may also be viewed as scarce resources. And perhaps today, and looking into the future, the most precious resource of all for both the United States as well as the rest of the world might be people, specifically working age people who can be trained in skill sets that a modern economy demands and that can productively contribute to the tax base instead of pulling from it. Many in the United States and in Europe, they fail to realize this reality, but a country who gets it and understands it quite well is China. The data, once again, as seems to be the theme of this episode, the data are telling. The working age population of high-income countries like those in Europe and the United States, it's already roughly doubled between 1950 and 2020. But now those working age populations in high-income countries, they've started to fall. And if fertility rates don't change, they're going to continue to fall by 20% by 2080. And that's a huge problem and threat to the prosperity and stability of the developed world, including China. Yes, I think it's old thinking and ridiculous these days to think of China as a developing nation. Anyway, Consider Japan. That's a good leading indicator, I think, of where the United States, Europe, and China may be heading. Japan today has 50 dependent elderly for every 100 workers. And that ratio, it's going to get worse by the end of the century. It's going to rise to 90 dependent elderly for every 100 workers by then. That's almost the ratio of 1 to 1. China faces a similar threat. Its ratio is going to rise from about 20 dependent elderly today for every 100 workers to 70 by 2080. So that's an accelerated increase in that ratio. Western Europe is currently at 40 elderly dependents for every 100 workers, and it's projected to rise to 70 over the same period of time, right where China's projected to increase to. Now, the United States is expected to go from about 30 elderly dependents for every 100 workers today to more than 50 by 2080, which is where Japan is currently at. When faced with such sobering demographic math, what's a nation to do in response? I mean, hopefully you would expect it's not going to sit there and wait for the crisis to develop or worsen. Well, the obvious answer is to revive fertility rates, a growing population organically, so to speak. But for most nations, from China to Europe to the United States, I wouldn't bank on such a silver bullet. People are getting married later and they're having less children. So that leaves four remaining options. You can impose significant austerity, but that creates political and social unrest. You can adopt mass immigration, but that brings problems of its own, as we've seen recently. You can look to rising productivity, but that's often easier said than done. And you can look to export capital and workers to employ on projects in developing nations that have a different set of demographics and economic opportunity. So what's China done? China has adopted modified versions of those last two alternatives, boosting productivity and exporting capital to developing nations as its answers to its eroding demographics when you look to the future. And the biggest tactical example of that strategy in play is China's Belt and Road Initiative. That initiative has been global in scope, and frankly, it's been agnostic relative to governance structure or form of government of the target nations for the Belt and Road investment. American Affairs performed a study recently looking for a correlation between where China is investing globally and the governance of those targeted nations. And you know what? They found no correlation. The $2 trillion Belt and Road Initiative is solving for something other than fostering communism across the globe. Although I might add that is likely a second or third order consequence and benefit of the effort from China's perspective. And you see this also with China's limited military global footprint beyond its borders. This was an amazing statistic to me. The United States has about 250,000 military personnel stationed overseas, while China has a couple hundred, all of them at its sole overseas base in Djibouti. Effectively, all of China's military resides within its immediate territorial interests. But then you look at things economically, you see a completely different story when it comes to Chinese global domination, ambition, and aggression. It dominates slews of industries, including telecom, energy, etc. And where it invests through its Belt and Road Initiative, you can be sure that you're going to find China exporting its own workforce to those faraway lands along with its capital. Indeed, China's applying a two-pronged tactical approach to achieve not only avoiding its demographic cliff, but also to expand by assimilation through infrastructure. That's why today, China's graduating more engineers and installs more robots than the rest of the world combined. Well, it's time to close up the far middle shop this week. I will make a connection to where we started, sports entertainment and the AFL, to a different area of the entertainment industry, and that's Hollywood and TV. Let's close with discussing one of the best shows during a great era of television. This week in 1975, the Barney Miller TV sitcom made its debut on ABC, and that's the same network that first televised AFL games. The TV series was set in a New York City Police Department police station, and I know the address because I'm a fan of the show. I can tell you that the station was in Greenwich Village in Lower Manhattan. And then the Far Middle research team provided more detail for a more exact address, East 6th Street in the Village. And no, the police station does not exist or did not exist in real life. The detectives were the stars and focus of the show. Suspects or citizens would appear as new actors each episode to drive the plot that week. Hal Linden was Captain Barney Miller and the show's marquee star. Series ran on ABC from January 23rd, 1975 until the middle of 1982. Eight glorious seasons. I like the sitcom for a couple of reasons. I think it had some really unique aspects. First, the sitcom takes place almost entirely, each episode, within the confines of the detective squad room and Captain Barney Miller's adjoining office of the police station. So this TV series, the sitcom, managed to be incredibly creative and impactful on a whole bunch of subjects and with the actors that they employed and utilized, despite limiting itself to a very tiny physical footprint or physical box. Second thing that I loved about the show was the theme song, of all things. And the theme song had no lyrics. The show's theme is an instrumental jazz fusion piece with a distinctive bass line. And it was improvised when the show's producer asked the musician to focus on the bass because he summed up the show concept as a main character being a cop in New York City. And wouldn't you know it, when you hear the theme music to Barney Miller, that musician captured gritty New York of the 1970s perfectly. Which brings up the third thing that I loved about Barney Miller. It provided one of my first impressions of New York when I was a kid. Part of that impression was the shots of Manhattan at the intro and close to accompany that baseline theme music. And the set of the police station, it was cluttered, it was dingy. The cast and the police force and the citizens, it was a cross-section of society, multiracial. And much of what I envisioned New York to be, I gained that view or that vision from shows like Barney Miller. And cops, they generally liked Barney Miller, and cops are notorious for not liking police shows. Many cops felt the show captured the essence of the job. I once read a story where a real-life cop commented, "Life really is more like Barney Miller than NYPD Blue, but our jokes aren't nearly as funny." Barney Miller was highly acclaimed, won multiple awards. The show was so successful that it spawned a spinoff series. And can you guess which one? It was Fish. And that one, that sitcom had a much shorter run in the late 1970s, and that focused on the Barney Miller character, Philip K. Fish, played by Abe Vigoda. And most of you film fans know Abe as Tessio from the Godfather epic. Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. And in between episodes, please follow me on X and LinkedIn. Check out nickdeolius.com. Always posting across those platforms, interesting content every day. And, I'm often asked across those different platforms and with the podcast, The Far Middle, what motivates me to do those things or to create those things? Well, I can explain by closing with a thought from the great Ayn Rand, a line from The Fountainhead. Have you read The Fountainhead? You must. You'll love it. Anyway, there is a character in the story named Heller, and he's a guy with individualistic beliefs, but who knows nothing about architecture. And this is a story about architecture, but he knows what he likes. So he ends up hiring the main character, Rourke, to build him a private home. And Heller is a man who trusts his own judgment. So although Rourke at the time had no professional credentials, Heller hires him on the sole basis of his sketch of the proposed house. So the merit of Rourke's design is the only credential that Heller really cared about. And Rourke throws everything he has into the project. He becomes maniacal about it, to the point where there's an exchange in the book and a line from Heller where he says or asks the architect Rourke, "After all, it's only a building. It's not the combination of holy sacrament, Indian torture, and sexual ecstasy that you seem to make of it." How did Rourke respond to that? "Isn't it?" That's a good close to think about with respect to what we do for a living, what inspires us, what we aim to accomplish, and for what motivates us all. Have a great week, everyone, and as always, stay connected to that far middle.